Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And today we're talking with Anne Marie Story. She is a partner at the law firm of Rudman and Winchell. And today we're going to be talking about FMLA. We have a lot of questions dealing with FMLA issues, and that's what we're going to talk about. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, we're going to be talking about what some people would say is an issue that is, dear to everybody's heart in HR, and that's FMLA.
I'm not sure dear is the right word. But.
Well, it might be deer in the headlight. How do you know there isn't a term to that? You're right. FMLA is one of those things where there are just so many issues and so many questions, right? So what I thought I'd do is kind of go through maybe first if you would give an overview of what FMLA is, which is the Family Medical Leave Act. Tell us a little bit about it. And then we'll kind of go down a laundry list of questions that I know people may want the answers to. So why don't you give an overview of it first, please?
Okay. Well, there are two different Family Medical Leave Acts. There's a federal version and a state version. And I think that's what causes a lot of angst for employers, because they could be subject to one or the other or both. And if they're subject to both, then they have to figure out how the different provisions apply, because they cover different things and they provide different levels of benefits. So what employers need to know, first of all, is whether or not they are covered. The state FMLA only applies to employers who employ 15 or more employees at one location. The federal FMLA does not kick in until an employer has 50 or more employees, but that's not limited to one location. That's at could be at numerous locations within a 75-mile radius. So that's the first question. Then once an employer determines which, if either, of the acts apply to them, they have to determine whether or not the employee is eligible for leave under one or both acts. And, of course, they have different qualifications. In order to qualify for federal leave, the employee has to have been employed for the employer for at least 12 months, but not consecutive months, and have worked at least 1,250 hours during the 12-month period immediately before the request for the leave. For state law, though, there is no hourly requirement, and the employee has to have worked for the employer for 12 consecutive months. So you can see that there are some substantial differences between these two. Generally, once an employer determines that they are covered and that an employee is eligible for one or both kinds of leave, the inquiry gets a little bit easier from there, because the covered leaves are not exact, but they are similar. And mostly what we see are employees who are requesting leave for their own serious health condition. But both acts also provide leave for the serious health condition of a covered family member, and also for the birth of a child and care of a newborn, or placement of a child with the employee for adoption or foster care. Now, federal law, there's one big difference there, because federal law also provides leave for two other military circumstances. One is called military caregiver leave, and that's for an employee to provide, to take leave off to care for a spouse, son, daughter, parent, or next of kin, and that allows them to take 26 weeks of leave, which is more than the ordinary amount available under federal law. And then there's also a provision called active duty leave, and that's to provide, or mostly to attend events either with or related to a covered family member who is an active service member. And that doesn't even begin to cover some of the issues that I think employers really struggle with, and those primarily involve when they're supposed to know that this act applies in the first place, and then how to apply it, particularly in circumstances where the request is for intermittent leave, as opposed to one block of time, because the block of time is fairly easy to both figure out and administer, but it gets very complicated once you get into the intermittent coverage.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that when you really start listening to what you're saying, there are so many, you know, you do this, but not this, but could be this, and might be that, and there's so many parts to this. You know, I guess the first question is, how does an employer know if they are covered by one or the other, other than the basic crest? Is there just a checklist if you have, you know, 50 employees, if you have 15 employees? Is that just where it starts, or are there other factors involved with that?
Well, mostly that's where it starts. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the difficulty, I mean, most of the large employers have processes in place, and they know what the policies are supposed to be, and they a lot of employers actually are now going to third-party administrators to deal with this entire issue of FMLA because it's just too complicated or too time-consuming to do on their own. But I think a lot of the trouble comes for smaller employers who may be covered but don't realize either that they're covered at all or that the act exists, or if it does exist, what does it mean? And that's what I see a lot in my practice, is that employers are just sort of mystified by this whole thing and don't know where to go to get the information that they need, you know, and beyond telling them, you know, without paying an attorney to advise them, really they're sort of stuck with searching the internet for information or turning to a local HR group. But generally, yeah, the first question is, am I even eligible? I mean, am I even covered as an employer for either one of these? And if so, what on earth does that mean for me?
Now, just to be clear, if you are covered, are there any requirements on the employee side? Are there any time frames or anything that's required by the employee before they're eligible?
Well, other than qualifying in terms of having worked there for the appropriate period of time and also the hourly requirement under federal law, the employee has an obligation, their own obligation, to inform an employer if they need time off for a covered medical or other condition. But an employee does not have to use the word FMLA. They don't even have to know what the act is. They just have to give the employer enough information that the employer can make a determination that this act potentially applies to them. The employee does have other obligations once an employer is aware that there is a covered condition. Then the employer has to get notice to the employee and the forms that the employee will need to have filled out, the medical certification and some of the other forms. And then the employee does have an obligation to return those in a timely manner. Usually it's 15 days from the date they get the form. It's got to be back. But of course, you know, seems like more often than not, there are problems with the doctor filling it out on time or the employee not returning it on time. And so those things rarely go as smoothly as one might hope.
So I'm an employer, and I fit within the criteria. So I guess there are obviously requirements, as I know there are, for this information to be posted, to be potentially in an employee handbook. Tell me a little bit about some of the things you recommend for an employer to do that are, one, required. What's that look like? And then second, what is best practice in terms of the notification side of for FMLA?
There are very definite posting requirements for an employer that has to follow. And in fact, there are really three different pieces or elements involved in that. One is notification of eligibility to the employee. And by the way, I should point out that these come straight from the federal regulations, but we apply them regularly to state law because there's very little interpretation of the state law. There are no regulations like there are with federal law. And so I would say that for an employer who's covered by state but not federal, they would be well advised to follow these same procedures. So the first thing is the notice of eligibility, and this has to be provided to an employee within 5 business days of the initial request for leave or the date when the employer determines that an employee's leave might be FMLA qualifying. And that notice should tell the employee about his or her eligibility status, and if they are determined not to be eligible, it has to say why. Now, there is a federal form available that meets the requirements of the Department of Labor, And I encourage employers to use those forms because arguably by doing that, they you know, by definition, meet what the requirements are.
Yeah, it's kind of the easy way to make sure you're in compliance.
Exactly. And those forms are available on the federal Department of Labor website, and you can just an employer can just print them off and use them. So first there's the notice of eligibility. Then second, there's a form called the Notice of Rights and Responsibilities. And this also has to be in writing. It has to include a specific list of information, including notice that the leave might be counted as FMLA, what the designated 12-month period for counting the entitlement is, and a bunch of other things. And so, I encourage employers to use the form produced by the DOL. And the one of the things that's quite important on there is the designated 12-month period for counting. And a lot of employers, I think, don't know, well, a lot of smaller employers don't know what that means. What it means is that an employer has the right to decide how the 12-month period will be counted, because the leave period is available during a 12-month period. So under federal law, the employee gets up to 3 months during the 12-month period. Under state law, they get 10 weeks in a two-year consecutive period. So the employer can determine whether to use, for instance, a rolling method or the calendar method. And there are a couple other ways to measure it, but those are the two most popular.
Yeah, can you describe that a little bit? I just want to make sure somebody going, what is a rolling method?
Yes.
I mean, calendar method sounds pretty easy to understand, but what's a rolling method?
The rolling method counts FMLA from the date it was first taken. And so that would trigger the beginning of the 12-month period during which the employee gets their 12 weeks. And that differs from the calendar period because, obviously, it's not based on just on a calendar year. It's based on the date when the leave is first requested. The reason that's more beneficial to an employer is because if you use the calendar method, the employee could potentially, let's say they ask for leave in October. So they've got 12 weeks of leave coming. They can use it October, November, and December. And then in January, under the calendar method, they get a renewed amount. Their eligibility starts all over again. So potentially they could take another 3 months right at the beginning of the new year and end up being out of work for 6 months. And so the rolling method prohibits that. Because you're counting from the date they first took it as opposed to being based solely on the calendar. And
so,
that's why that method is better for employers.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, an employer, any employer that I would think of, it wouldn't make any sense to do it the other way. Why would an employer think of using the calendar method?
Well, actually, I'm not sure that it's a conscious decision by employers to do that, because I'm convinced, other than, you know, the more savvy employers, I think a lot of employers don't even realize that there are differences in the way it can be calculated.
I think you're right.
And what the regulations say is that if the employer does not specifically designate a method, then it reverts to the calendar method. And so that's why. So unless you specifically, essentially opt out of the calendar method, that's what you're going to be stuck with. But employers should also be aware, if they're listening and think, oh, okay, I'm going to go change my policy today to the rolling method. Under the regulations, you have to give employees 60 days advance notice of any change in the way it's calculated. So please don't just, you know, say,
just don't go on. Let's switch it up.
Make the change.
Absolutely. Well, we're speaking with Anne Marie Story. She's a partner at the banker law firm of Rudman & Winchell. And we'll be right back to talk more about FMLA issues. You're listening to News Talk WLOB. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
I am pleased to announce another national sponsor for the HR Power Hour. It is the Northern Insurance Group. They do business, commercial, and personal insurance and are licensed agents in 28 states. Northern Insurance Group is an independent insurance agency with a staff that offers over 60 years of experience. They represent a carefully selected group of reputable insurance companies that will make the best decisions for their clients. Whether you are an individual, a group, an association, or a business, their staff is committed to excellence and making sure that you get the right insurance. You can count on an experienced staff at Northern Insurance Group to put together the best program available to you. So go to northerninsurancegroup.com. That's northerninsurancegroup.com. Or call 207-878-7602. That's 207-878-7602. HR Power Hour is proud to have you as a sponsor. And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Anne-Marie, thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, we've been talking about FMLA and FMLA issues, and you've provided a whole bunch of nuggets of information during the first segment, and I have no doubt there'll be more during this one. I guess the question that always comes up, now that we've determined, you know, basically that you can have an employee and they have to be there so many, you know, months, and they have to have so many requirements of hours, all that sort of stuff. There's been changes in the law that are having to do with same-sex marriage, for example, and partner, you know, different things out there. Has this had any effect with the change in FMLA law federally or maybe at state levels? And as you probably know, this show is heard across a number of states, so I think that would be interesting to hear about.
Yes, it does have a direct impact both on federal and state. So under state law, Maine's FMLA had already recognized domestic partner as a covered individual at the time the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. So we were already dealing with coverage under the FMLA for people who met that definition. What's important for people in Maine to know, though, is that the definition of domestic partner under state law is more broad than just a same-sex partner. And so while same-sex partners are likely covered under that definition, other people could be too. So I just don't want employers to say, oh, well, that's, you know, it just means same-sex partner and that's all I have to worry about, because that's not necessarily true. So what that did is it created an interesting situation for states that, because there were other states besides Maine that included domestic partner already in their law. And so what it did is it created a major difference between the two, the result of which was if more than one request for leave was made and the requests were made in a particular order, an employee could end up taking, in Maine, 10 weeks of Maine leave and then also, on top of that, 12 weeks of federal leave in the same year. And the way that would happen is if the employee's initial request for leave, let's say in February, they asked for leave relating to a same-sex partner that was covered under the state law, they would be entitled to their 10 weeks of leave, but it did not run concurrently with federal law because it was not a covered condition under federal. And that's another important thing for employers to understand, is that when the two laws line up, the leave runs concurrently under both. So you're using up your leave under both state and federal at the same time. But when they don't line up, you're only using one at a time. So somebody in February who asked for domestic partner leave could take 10 weeks under state law, and then in, let's say, August, breaks their own leg and says, now I need 12 weeks of leave for my own medical condition. Well, they've used up their state law, but they still have federal available, so they could take another 12 weeks. So that's not likely to happen so much anymore because when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, what it did is included same-sex married couples to be treated the same way as other married couples under federal law. And that means that because the definition of spouse under federal FMLA is defined as a husband or wife, as defined or recognized under state law for purposes of marriage in the state where the employee resides, that means that states that recognize same-sex marriages, those individuals are now covered under federal FMLA.
So let me ask you a question. You have an employer that is in multiple states, and one state recognizes same-sex marriage and the other state does not. So the two questions come up with that. One, do you go by the state that they live in and work in, or if they are remote, for example, and you're a corporate office somewhere, how does it work? Is it the home state? Is it the state you're in? How does that whole thing play out?
Well, that's a little bit unclear, but I would say the interpretation is an employer can end up with people covered in one state but not in another state, even though they all work for the same employer. And I think it would be in the state in which the employee resides and works. So if an employer has a facility in Maine and also one in a state that does not provide coverage or recognize same-sex marriages, if I live and work in Maine and I am in a same-sex relationship, then I would be covered under the federal law now as well. But my counterpart in whatever state that isn't covered would not be entitled to that right. And so that's very important for national employers to be sure that their policies are consistent with whatever the state law is.
Yeah, I could see that being an issue where you could hear I could just hear employees saying that's not fair, right? It's just not fair.
For sure.
And you could have all sorts of potential issues, you know, for people say, well, we're, you know, you guys are based in Maine, for example, and you should have Maine. And then, of course, employers have the right to do it if they want across the country. That's their choice, correct?
That's right. An employer can be more inclusive if they choose to. And so I certainly see for purposes of fairness, I will certainly have employers who will say, well, we just don't like the way it's perceived. If we're going to provide this benefit for one person, then we're going to give it to everybody, and so they voluntarily provide it. And that's fine. The only way I see that tripping employers up is when a problem employee, if you will, wants to take the leave, and all of a sudden the employer says, well, it's not covered under our policy, so you can't do it. And then they treat somebody else who's maybe a really good employee differently, and you can't do that.
Sure. Are children covered under FMLA?
An employee can take leave for when they are needed to care for a spouse, child, or parent. So in that sense, yes, if I have an ill child, that's one of the reasons why I would be able to take covered leave, and also for the birth of a child or adoption.
Okay, great. So let me ask you another question having to do with FMLA time. If an employer requests FMLA time, can the employer ask for all related medical information for this?
No. An employer has very specific limitations on what they can get under the FMLA. And really, the answer is you want as little as possible. They certainly do not want to be asking an employee, hey, produce your entire medical file from, you know, your treating physician. And that's why employers really should just stick to using the medical certification form that's put out by the Department of Labor, because it limits a doctor to exactly what an employer is permitted to have under the FMLA, and that's all that they should get.
Let me ask you one question, though, if I could. If an employee brings that information in, they just happen to say, hey, I'm giving you all this information because I don't know if you need it. And they're not necessarily as an employer supposed to get it. But the employee, just out of, you know, I want to make sure the file's complete, provides the information. What does the employer do?
I wouldn't take it. I would tell them that they're not entitled to have it. They, meaning the employer, shouldn't have it, and that they would appreciate it if the employee would instead have their doctor fill out the medical certification. And that's for a couple reasons. One is purely because they're not supposed to have it. But two, the employer should not be the one making the determination as to whether or not the, whatever's in the meds qualifies under the FMLA, because that would be the result. So then you've got an employer pawing through an employee's medical record saying, well, is this enough? Does this meet the definition of a serious health condition? And I just don't, that's not what an employer should be doing at all. So I would say, thank you very much. You know, I appreciate the effort. This is not what I need. Here's the medical certification form. Have your doctor fill it out.
Employers have requirements having to do with filing of employee files. One of the things that get separated is medical information. Obviously, medical notes, different things that come in regarding medical. Do you have anything that would say that the FMLA paperwork should be in that file? Should it be in the employee files? I'm just trying to get a little bit of the background information of where this information should be kept.
It should be kept separate and confidential, just like any other medical information. It should not be kept in an ordinary personnel file, although in Maine it is still part of the personnel file because of the way in which the definition is written, but it should be maintained separately in a locked place and confidentially.
Okay, that's good, because that's what I thought was the answer. Just making sure, double checking here for employers out there. When there's an issue that comes up with FMLA and an employer says, no, we're not going to grant it for whatever the reason may be, does an employee have an opportunity to appeal that some way, or on the reverse side, if the employee really is insistent, where's the ground, where does that go?
Well, I think it, in some ways it depends on the reason why they're saying it's not, the employee's not eligible. So if the employee, and that's part of what has to be on that form, the notice and designation form that the employer gives back to the employee, because if they say you're not eligible, they have to specify why. And so the common reasons for that would be you haven't worked here long enough, or you didn't have enough hours to qualify, or the medical certification is not sufficient. And so there are different ways to deal with that. I would say an employer should always engage in further conversation with the employee if the employee disputes it. I would never tell an employer just to walk away and say, too bad, we've made the decision, I don't want to hear what you have to say. So if an employee comes and says, well, you said I didn't work 1,250 hours, but according to my records, I clearly did, then they should engage in that discussion and come to a decision by evaluating whatever the employee presents. Now, if it's because the medical certification is not sufficient, that's a different story. And the regulations provide a process by which the employer can fix the problem. And so an employer can make contact directly with the medical provider under very certain circumstances. But primarily what I would say is if the certification comes back and it's either not filled out completely or you can't read it or it doesn't make any sense, then I would say to the employee, I need you to get the doctor to fix this. But there is, eventually you could get to the point where certain representatives of the employer could contact the doctor's office directly for clarification purposes. So while I wouldn't say there's an appeal, quote unquote, right to a decision, I think an employer should always engage in the discussion about what the problem is and how to fix it.
Well, that's certainly the right thing to do. We're talking to Anne Marie Story. She is a partner at the Bangor Law Firm of Rudman and Winchell. And we will be right back. You are listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan.
Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan.
Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan? I like bronze, like my tan. Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group. Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
I want to introduce you today to a new HR Power Hour sponsor. It's the AARP. They, of course, are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization with a membership of, yes, more than 37 million people. Here in Maine, there are over 230,000 members, and their office is located right here in Portland, Maine. Their work spans the entire state, and they are a trusted source for lifestyle tips, news, and educational information, AARP products, and certainly the AARP magazine. AARP is a great organization. They help people turn their goals and dreams into real possibilities. They strengthen communities and fight for the issues that matter most to families such as healthcare, employment security, and retirement planning. So I want to thank the AARP as a new member of the HR Power Hour sponsor family. So for more information about the AARP in Maine, go to www.aarp.org/ME. And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Our sponsors for today's show, AARP, taking on issues that matter. Northern Insurance Group, meeting your business, commercial, and personal insurance needs. And the law firm of Jackson Lewis, all we do is work. And we're talking with Anne-Marie Story, who is the partner at Bangor Law Firm of Rudman & Winchell. And we've been talking about FMLA, more fun than one person should be allowed to have when we have this topic. Don't you think, Anne-Marie?
I definitely do.
Well, you know, it's an important topic. There's no doubt about it. And really what I like of what you're providing is a lot of very good nuggets of information for employers, smaller employers that may not have the HR help. And I think it's good information for them. So let me go into a different segment having to do with FMLA for a minute here. And I think the question centers around the FMLA, the ADA, and workers' comp. And the question is, how do these all interact? How do these all work together? How does this create issues for employers?
I think the question is, how does it not create issues for employers? I mean, this is one of the hardest things, I think, for employers to deal with. Because there is a lot of interaction between these three laws, and it's very difficult sometimes for employers to keep track of. So let me hit a couple of highlights. First of all, there are huge differences in what is required by each of these laws in terms of accommodation and return to work. There is no accommodation requirement under the FMLA. So at the end of the employee's FMLA period, they must return to their same original job without needing restrictions or changes to the job. They must be able to perform all aspects of the regular job at the end of their FMLA period. That is very different, of course, than the ADA, and most importantly for employers, It does not mean that an employer can just terminate somebody when their FMLA is up. And it seems like I talk about this all the time because the inclination is, well, the 12 weeks have gone by, they can't come back to work, so I'm done, right? And I can just send them a letter saying, you know, we're finished. But that is not the case. There is no question that if the employee has a condition that qualifies as a disability under state or federal law, then at the end of the FMLA, the employer is still charged with determining whether or not a reasonable accommodation can be made for that person. And that reasonable accommodation could be extending the leave period. So even though they've now been out for 12 weeks of FMLA time, it's entirely possible that they will get or be entitled to some additional leave time as an accommodation. And so that's really the primary difference. Another major difference is that the FMLA, the reason why it's so protective of employees is because it absolutely guarantees a restoration of the employee to their regular position, ideally, or to a position that's equivalent in all ways. During the period of the FMLA time, the employer must either keep the job open or at least fill it only temporarily until the employee is either ready to return or the time runs out and they can't return. Now, that's different under the ADA, because if you've got somebody out with a disability, ideally you want to try and keep the job open as an accommodation, but there's no absolute requirement that you do that, and in fact you could move somebody to a different kind of job that better fits their needs and as an accommodation. So that's another major difference. Now, workers' comp plays into all this as well, at least in the state of Maine, primarily because if somebody has a condition that qualifies as a serious health, if somebody has a workers' comp injury, that same condition may very well qualify as a serious health condition under the FMLA. And if that's the case and the person is out on workers' comp leave, the employer would likely want to also start their FMLA time and give them notice that they're doing that so that the time runs concurrently. And I find that a lot of employers are not aware that you can run FMLA concurrently with workers' comp time.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they aren't aware of a lot of that, because the reality is you don't hear that. Employers do that very often. They think they're separate.
Oh, that's very true. And you know, it's not as easy as it sounds, just like everything else with the FMLA, because you may have somebody who's out, for a couple of days, and then it doesn't turn into anything more. And so is it worth, all the effort it takes to get the forms out under the FMLA and start that time? Probably not. But on the other hand, if you've got somebody with a pretty serious injury and it's clear they are going to be out for an extended period of time, or if, as what often happens, they're out for a couple of days, come back, and then all of a sudden they go out again and, the back gets worse or whatever it is, and then they're going to be out for a pretty good period of time, then I think you absolutely do want to start running the FMLA.
Absolutely.
Because the result could be that you have somebody out on workers' comp for, let's say, a month or 2 months, and then they come back, and then they're still going to be entitled to take their FMLA time. And the FMLA is very clear that an employer must designate it. They've got to tell the employee that they're using that time. There are very limited circumstances when you can go back and say, oh, well, you've now been out 6 months, so that's, you used up your FMLA. You can't really do that.
So let's have a little bit of a definition clarification, if we can. Under FMLA, a family member wants to take some leave for needed to care for another, a family member, for example. Can you explain that to me?
Yes, it's actually a lot broader than most employers realize. And there have been a lot of cases, it seems like, on this the last couple of years. Needed to care for does not just mean that I need to be home administering medication or something like that to a covered family member. It's essentially broad enough to include any kind of care, including psychological care. And so if I have an ill parent who's in the hospital or at home with a serious health condition, and that person needs me there for moral support or just to sit there and hold their hand or whatever the case might be, that is likely going to be covered leave. It can also include things like making arrangements for a covered family member if they are, for instance, leaving the hospital but going to a rehab facility, and all those arrangements need to be made. Those can be things that are included within the needed to care for provision. There was kind of a funny case, actually, in the last couple of years about this. And what happened was the employee was providing care to her mother, who had a sort of a COPD condition, had a lot of difficulty breathing. And the employee lived with her and fixed her meals and, took her to appointments and did the housework and things like that. And the employer was always agreeable that counted as needed to care for leave and allowed the employee the FMLA time. And then what happened was the covered mother won a trip to Las Vegas as sort of a, you know, end-of-life special thing, a make-a-wish kind of trip. And so the employee told the employer that she was going to go with her because she was still caring for her, you know, and providing the same services there that she would be providing at home. And the employer apparently took some issue with the fact that this was being done in casinos and shows and, you know, whatever else was going on in Las Vegas, and denied the leave. And they were ultimately found to be in the wrong for doing that, because she was providing the same care there that she was providing at home.
That could make for some interesting interesting challenges, because I could see where potentially you could see employees, you know, maybe take advantage of that.
No, I can't believe that that could happen. Well, yes, you know, and that's why it's actually kind of a fun topic to talk about, because there's all kinds of really great decisions about it. And in another decision, for instance, the employee, for whatever reason, decided that he was going to take this needed to care for leave for his estranged father who had cancer. And although the father's condition was covered, of course, he apparently didn't want this care from this estranged son. And so when the employer challenged the leave and the employee sued, the employer took testimony from the father, the covered family member, who basically said, "I don't need him and I don't want him around me." And so needless to say, the employee lost.
No family dynamics there at all. None.
No. Well, jeez. And that's the problem. That's sort of what you get into with some of these claims. There's all kinds of cases about people traveling to have treatment, and, you know, and they always seem to be in these great exotic locales, and then the employee wants to go. And so, yeah, there are a lot of ways where this can cause some serious difficulty.
We're speaking with Anne-Marie Story. She's a partner at the Bangor Law Firm of Rudman & Winchell. We're talking about the FMLA issues, and we will be right back on News Talk WLOB or WLOBRadio.com.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan.
Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan.
Not the silver plan. Too much trouble? Do they have a stainless steel plan?
I like bronze, like my tan.
Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group. Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. You know, Anne-Marie, we have talked a lot about the FMLA and the FMLA issues. And by the way, we are speaking with Anne-Marie Story. She's the partner of the Bangor Law Firm of Rudman & Winchell. And one of the things that we haven't really discussed is what an employer can do if an employee is actually abusing FMLA.
Well, there are steps the employer can take, and we can talk about those, but I want to caution everybody to be very careful about this, because there is a claim under the FMLA for interference with somebody's leave or, of course, retaliation for the employee either taking the leave or making the request for it. And, you know, an employer will have to be careful about stepping into those areas. So, but if there is a feeling that the employee really is abusing it, I guess the response sort of depends on the reason for the abuse. If it's a medical condition that the employer has good reason to think is not credible, then there are some procedures they can follow in terms of recertification. But again, they have to be really careful, because if a doctor has certified the condition as being covered, just because the employer says, well, that just doesn't seem right to me, or this doesn't seem like they're bad off enough to me, that's not really a good reason to deal with this kind of fraudulent behavior kind of issue. But if the employer sees something or has information come to their attention that they think a doctor didn't have, or that really really does reflect on the credibility of the condition. Like, for instance, you know, they say they broke their leg, but then they're seen skiing, you know, the next weekend. Then there are procedures they can follow with recertification by the employee's own physician. And there certainly are cases out there where an employer has won the right to deny the leave and terminate the employee based on fraudulent behavior. But I also have employers who will say, well, they say that they have a, you know, they have this virus or something, or they're supposed to be staying home and taking care of their sick parent, but, you know, we've seen them in Walmart. Well, that's just not good enough, you know, because there's a million reasons why they could be there, including getting medication for somebody or for themselves. And, you know, courts have regularly said people have to eat, people have to get groceries, and so even if you're sick, it doesn't mean just because you're running errands that you're being fraudulent. I've also actually had employers ask if they could put a GPS tracker on an employee's vehicle because they don't believe that they're at home when they say they're at home, or that, you know, they think they're off doing something else, and clearly that's not okay. So there are situations where fraud can be dealt with, but I think employers have to be very careful about that.
So what obligation does an employer have to return an employee to work at the end of the FMLA time? Let's clarify that so that there's no doubt about it.
Well, you know, as I said earlier, the FMLA has a very specific and strong statement that the employee is absolutely absolutely entitled to be reinstated to their position, the same position, when they return from leave, or if it's not the same position, it has to be an equivalent position, and that's a very high standard.
So can the employer just fire them if they can't make it? I mean, that's the bottom line question.
Well, again, you know, maybe, but if the employee's condition, if the employee can't come back to their regular job at the end of the FMLA, but their condition also qualifies as a disability or they're on workers' comp, then their employer is going to have further obligations. So the answer would be no, unlikely.
So employers want to do the right thing, right? That's predominantly when I speak to employers across the states, and when I speak to, you know, CEOs, CFOs, HR professionals, senior business leaders, they all want to do the right thing. Part of the challenge with the FMLA is the, what I would say, onerous number of rules and what-ifs and could-bes and kindas that you have to deal with within that. What is your recommendation as we wind down the end of this show for an employer to deal with? What are some of the top things that they should deal with? How should they handle this in a best practice way to make it so that it works for everyone, the employees and the employer?
Well, I think the first thing is to educate themselves. I think employers have an obligation to know, you know, which of these laws they're covered under, if either or both, and what those obligations require them to do. And that, of course, will make everything run much more smoothly from there. Then I think the right thing to do is to communicate to employees that there is this policy and that this is what it means and these are the reasons why they might be entitled to leave, and this is how the whole thing is going to work. And so everybody's sort of on the same page. if I were to give one sort of best practice, my primary best practice for the FMLA, it would be this. When an employee is on intermittent leave, meaning that they take, you know, an hour here, a half a day there, a full day here, as opposed to being out for the solid 3 months or something, when they're on the intermittent leave, the employer must keep very specific track of the time they're missing and the reason the time is missed, whether it's FMLA qualifying or not. And the reason for that is because when the employee finally reaches the 12-week cap, assuming that they do within that year, the employer is then in a position to say, you're out of FMLA, and so unless there's a disability, any further absences could potentially be subject to disciplinary action. And more often than not, the employee at that point will come back and say, well, you miscounted my time, and I actually have more days left. And so if you fire me, it's going to be FMLA interference or retaliation. So what I advise my employers to do is that on a regular basis, when somebody's on intermittent leave, meaning weekly or biweekly, but probably no more than that, they have a listing of all the time the employee missed and all of that time that is designated as FMLA as opposed to something else. And they have the employee sign off each period saying, yes, I agree that that is FMLA designated time. And that will solve the problem at the end when you get to the cap on the leave, that you've got pretty much solid proof, if you will, that the leave has been used up.
Now, that's great information, great tips. I think this has been a great informative show. Anne-Marie, I really appreciate you being on the show today. Obviously, if someone wants to reach you, they can go to rudmanwinchell.com. What's your email address?
It is a story, and that's with an EY, at rudmanwinchell.com.
Awesome. And also, people can go to the HR Power Hour site after this show, and they'll see your information and a direct link to you. Anne-Marie, thank you again for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now the HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group. Licensed agents in 28 states, business, commercial, and personal. Go to northerninsurancegroup.com. The Supreme Court's DOMA ruling earlier this year, which expands the federal definition of marriage to include same-gender spouses, has a significant effect on federal laws, including payroll taxes and health insurance, as well as employment law, such as the Family Medical Leave Act. Affected employees are now eligible to pay for same-gender spousal benefits, such as health insurance premiums and FSA Section 125 participation on pre-tax basis for federal taxes. In addition, employers may be entitled to a refund of federal unemployment tax on wages paid to legally married same-gender spouses. And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group at northerninsurancegroup.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with Todd Churches. He's the CEO and co-founder of Big Blue Gumball. It is a management and leadership and consulting training and executive coaching firm in New York, New York. And we're going to be talking about visual thinking and communication in the HR world and how it can impact your life. And that is the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.